"Tell off," said Banks, muffled behind the sleeve of his coat. "It's not natural. I know that." "Well, you say so," said Will, whose eyes streamed. "You say so. But nothing's more natural than the smell of dead things, which I suppose this must be. You and I will both smell similar, given time." The small crowd observed him with distaste, and he rightly judged that humour was not fitted to the moment. "All right, try scripture then. Therefore we will not fear, though the waters roar and be troubled, and what have you." "I'll tell you what it is," said Harriet's mother. "And I needn't tell you, Banks, need I? Or you? Or you?" She nodded with meaning at Mr. Caffin, and at one or two women who seemed indifferent to the vileness of the air and had already begun to wander up the high road towards the black water where dawn had taken hold. "It's come to us at last, the Essex serpent, the river beast, and none of us ready for it. It came to my little one first. Oh, you bet. You bet. It came to her first, and she's sick as a dog, and nothing our say'll comfort the girl." Evansford remarked that, after all, it had been promised by the Redeemer himself there'd be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. And bolstered by this observation, the woman went on. "It's the breath of the thing. The very breath of it, I tell you. And on it, there's the flesh and bones of everything it ever had between its jaws. The St. Osyth boy, the man washed up on our shores. A foul miasma, as our fathers were taught," said Mr. Caffin, "and bringing with it disease. Look, I have a fever. La peste. It has begun." And certainly his high scholar's brow was beaded with drops of sweat, and as Will watched he began to tremble and twist his mouth into what may have been either the beginnings of a sob or of laughter. "The sea gave up the dead which were in it," said Banks, growing excited. If hope was gone of holding Naomi alive in his arms, he at least might have the pleasure of giving her a tomb. "And death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them." "Hell! Miasma!" said Will, growing exasperated, and discovering that either the smell had begun to recede or that he'd grown accustomed to disgust. "Serpent! Plague! Mr. Caffeen, you're not ill. It's just that you could do with a cup of tea." "What? I know you all for sensible folk. Banks, it was you yourself who showed me how the sextant worked. Caffeen, I've seen you teach my daughters how to calculate the distance of a storm. We're not in the Dark Ages. Not children kept in line with tales of ghouls and demons. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. There's nothing there. Nothing to fear. There never was. We will go down and find nothing but a sheep washed up from Malden Way. Not some abomination sent for our punishment." But was it so great a stretch to imagine the intelligence that once had split the Red Sea, taking the trouble to send a little admonition to the sinners of a briny Essex parish? The Apostle Paul had put his hand in a nest of snakes and come away unpoisoned by way of a sign. Certainly, the world had turned its many thousand revolutions since. But was the season of signs and wonders really over? Why had it always seemed to him so preposterous that in the estuary something was biding its time? Was it a question not of failure to believe in the serpent, but of failure to believe in his God? The fear of the crowd came then to Will, with the taste of a copper penny placed on his tongue, and it was not the fear that they were under divine judgment, but that they were not and could never be. Cora, he thought, finding himself grasping at the empty air, as if he might somehow summon up her strong hand. Cora! If she were here. If she were here. Right then, he said, grown angry, attempting to conceal it. What use is it to stand here and choke and imagine? I'll go down and see for myself, and you may come or not, as you like. But I tell you by sunset there'll be an end to all this, and there'll be no more talk of serpents. He struck out east, up the high road, towards the Blackwater and the source of their disgust. Muttering and squabbling in his wake, the small crowd followed. Harriet's mother took his arm confidingly and said, I bid good-bye to the child at the door as I left her, not knowing if I'd make my way home. On the common, Traitor's Oak was so thick with rooks it might have been a crop of feathered fruit. Will walked in its shadow. The avid flock fell silent. The stench grew intolerable, and Mr. Caffeine, seeing the lit windows of the school, peeled away to find refuge, saying that he ought not to have taken up a post in so remote and muddy a location, but that at any rate he couldn't say he hadn't been warned. Then the pitying wind relented and changed its course. Rooks lifted from the oak with a look of black ashes blown up from burning sheets of paper. With the changed air, the odour began to recede, blown back out towards the estuary, where others would wake to foulness in the morning. Banks, taking courage, sang a scrap of sea shanty and took a nip of rum. Then there was World's End, and each averted their eyes, though they'd seen the mossy tump where Cracknell lay waiting for his headstone. It was none the less impossible to think that he could not be there behind the mottled glass. Picking at earwigs on the sleeve of his coat. A handful now, that was all. William Ransom, with a mother on his left, and a riverman on his right, and behind them, Evansford, mercifully silent. The two women, gone on ahead, talked cheerily enough, gesturing at scraps of cloud, stained red by the sun's rising, turning to bat at the air as if they might fend off the odour, which strengthened again as they drew near the saltings. Will's stomach turned in revulsion and fear. He did not believe they were shortly to encounter the Essex serpent, sunning its thin wings on the shingle, snapping its beak, regurgitating a fragment of bone, but, oh, he was uneasy. Cora! He said aloud, appalled at his own voice, which had the inflection of a man blaspheming. Banks, at his side, cast up a glance of confusion, and May himself has spoken, had one of the women ahead not paused on the path, flung an arm down towards the shore, and begun to shriek. Her companion reeled with the shock of it, and stepping on the hem of her dress, tripped, and unable to right herself, staggered down the incline, her mouth gaping in fear. There was a moment which Will later recalled as having been fixed, as if on the photographer's plate. The falling woman, Banks arrested in motion as he moved towards her, himself, useless, in his mouth a sweet foulness that lifted up from the rising estuary tide. Then the image broke, and by some means he could never adequately explain, they were all down on the salt shingle, standing by the black bones of Leviathan, looking in terror and pity at what the sea had given up. In parallel to the lapping water's edge, the carcass of a creature lay in putrefaction. It measured perhaps 20 feet in length, so that its further end seemed to taper almost to a point. It was wingless, limbless, its body taut as a drummed skin and gleaming silver. All along the spine the remnants of a single fin remained. Protrusions, rather like the spokes of an umbrella between which fragments of membrane, drying out in the easterly breeze, broke and scattered. The falling woman had stumbled upon its head, eyes large in diameter, as a clenched fist looked blindly out, and behind them a pair of gills split away from the silvery flesh and showed, deep within, a crimson meaty frilling that resembled the underside of a mushroom. Either it had suffered an attack, or caught against the hull of a Thames barge making its way to the capital. In places the taut hide, which gleamed where the low sun struck it with the colours of oil on water, had opened up to show bloodless wounds. Wherever it had touched the mud and shingle, it had left a greasy residue, as if fat had begun to render out of its skin. Within its open mouth, which had about it something like the blunt beak of a finch, very fine teeth could be seen. As they watched, a portion of flesh fell away from the bone as cleanly as if tucked with a diner's knife.
"Look," said Banks. "That's all it was. That's all it was."
He plucked off his hat and held it to his breast, looking absurdly as if he'd encountered there in the Essex dawn the Queen on her way to Parliament.
"Poor old thing. That's all it was. Out there in the dark. Lost, I dare say. Damaged. Cast up on the marsh and sucked back out on the tides."
And it did seem a poor old thing, thought Will, for all its look of having detached itself from the illuminated margins of a manuscript. Not the most superstitious of men could have believed this decaying fish to be a monster of myth. It was simply an animal, as they all were, and was dead, as they all would be. There they stood, reaching by silent agreement the conclusion that the mystery had not been solved so much as denied. It was impossible to imagine that this blind, decaying thing, cast out of its element, where its silver flank must have been lithe, beautiful, could have caused their terror. Where, besides, were the promised wings, the muscular limbs from which claws protruded? Perhaps it might have coiled Cracknell in a wet embrace out there in the Blackwater estuary. But Cracknell had died on the dry shore and with his boots on.
What should we do?
Said Evansford, looking as if he rather regretted the bright sun rising, the pathos of the corpse at his feet, the staying of the hand of judgment.
"It can't be left. It'll poison the river."
"The tide'll take it,"
said Banks, sure-footed. No one knew dead fish as well as he.
"The tide, the gulls."
Then,
"Something is moving,"
said Harriet's mother, who'd walked a little onward and stood at the place where the creature's belly bulged against the shingle.
"Something inside is moving."
Will came near and saw a kind of shiver and writhing behind the skin. It paused, so that he rubbed his eyes, imagining that his vision had grown disordered by the early morning and the low sun. He opened them again, and all at once, as if slipping free of many small buttons, the belly opened up along the seam and spilled out a pale and writhing mass. The stench was unbearable. Each staggered back as if struck by a blow, and Banks could not prevent himself from running to Leviathan's bones and vomiting. He could not look. He could not. He imagined that there among the white fragments still moving he might see a skein of red hair. But one of the women, indifferent to the sight, stirred at the glistening mess with her foot and said,
"Tapeworm! Look at it! Yards long! And still hungry!"
Probably did for the beast. Starved it from the inside.
Seen it happen before. You not going to take a look, Reverend? Found you had something to fear after all.
Inclining his head, he knew when he was bested. Will did take a look, reeling a little, saw the worm's last movements and its peculiar look of a length of white ribbon into which threads had been irregularly woven. What was the creator thinking of, to come up with so revolting a creature, which, moreover, lived off the life of others? He supposed it served some purpose.
"Banks," said Will,
suppressing the urge to deliver a short homily which emphasized his rightness in countering the villagers' superstitious fears with godly reason.
"Banks, what ought we to do?"
"Leave it,"
said Banks, in whose wet eyes new veins had broken.
"High tide'll take it, due 11, or just after. Nature has her ways."
"And no harm done to the herring, the oyster beds?"
"See the gulls, see the rooks, followed us from the common. Short work of it they'll make, and the water. Come Sunday, no sign of it."
Nothing now moved. The lens of the creature's eye grew milky. Will imagined, knowing himself foolish, that from the open mouth a last breath came. The shingle stirred. The tide edged nearer. On the toe of his boot a dark stain showed, and its edge was rimmed with salt. Catherine Ambrose, care of All Saints Rectory, Oldwinter, 11th of September.
"Our darling Cora, have you heard? What with your determination to no longer be interested in poor old Essex. Really, I never knew a fad of yours fall from favour so fast. I dare say you remain in the dark. So, for once, I get the pleasure of telling you something you don't already know, which is this. They have found the Essex serpent. Now, dust yourself down and fetch a cup of tea. Charles, who reads over my shoulder, says, if the sun's over the yard arm, you must get a glass of something strengthening. And I'll tell all. And since I am currently in Oldwinter, I have it direct from the Reverend William Ransom, whom you and I both know to be incapable of transgressing so far as to exaggerate. So, you must take this report to be as sober and truthful as if it came from the pen of the man himself. Well, it happened like this. Yesterday morning, the entire village was woken by the most disgusting smell. I gather at first some thought they'd all been poisoned, since it was bad enough to make them sick in their beds. Can you imagine? At any rate, apparently they summoned up the courage to go down to the shore, and there it was. The beast itself, only dead as a doornail. Quite as big as they'd feared. Will estimates 20 feet, only not at all bulky, rather like an eel, he said, and shining like silver, or mother of pearl, he grows poetical in his old age. Those that saw it knew at once how foolish they'd been, no monster after all, and certainly no wings. It looked as if it might take a chunk out of your leg, but would have had no end of trouble getting out of the water to snatch a sheep or a child. I gather there was an unpleasant moment with a parasite of some kind, which I do not wish to dwell on, but there you have it. A beast, I suppose, but no more strange, no more dangerous than an elephant or crocodile.
Now, I know you'll be wondering whether it bore any resemblance to the sea serpents which your beloved Mary Anning had a habit of digging up. And I regret to tell you that it did not. Will says it had no limbs of any kind, and that for all its size and strangeness, it was quite unmistakably nothing but a fish. There was talk of notifying the authorities. Will sent a message to Charles, since we happened to be in Colchester at the time. But apparently it broke up when the tide came in and got washed back out to sea. Oh, Cora, I can't help feeling rather sorry for you. What a letdown. I had high hopes for that case in the British Museum, and inside a monstrous sea serpent stuffed and fitted with glass eyes, and there on the wall your name on a brass plate. Now what a disappointment to those looking forward to Judgment Day. I wonder if they repent of their repentance. I know I would. The following day, we came down to Oldwinter, half hoping to see the wretch for ourselves. So, I write to you from Will's study. It's warm and mild. The window's open, and I can see a goat cropping grass on the lawn. How curious it is to be here without the Ransom children, knowing they're back at our own home in London. All the world is topsy-turvy. And how curious it is to be here among things I recognise as yours. Your letters. I didn't look, though I was sorely tempted. A glove, which I know to be yours. A fossil. An ammonite, I think, which can only have come from you. I almost think I can smell that scent of yours, which is always like the first rain of spring. As if you'd only just got up out of the chair where I am sitting. Will keeps odd books for a vicar. Here's Marx and Darwin. No doubt getting along very well. Oldwinter is quite transformed. When we arrived this morning to what, frankly, I've always thought a dour sort of village, a festival was taking place. The children are out to play again, since there's no danger of encountering a beast behind the hedges, and the women had laid out blankets on the grass and sat leaning against each other, gossiping no end. We finished up the summer's cider, delicious and far better than any wine I've ever had in this county. I made short work of an entire Essex flitch of ham. Darling Stella, even more beautiful. I'd be prepared to swear than when I saw her last. Really, I think it's terribly unfair. Put on a blue dress and danced a little while the fiddlers played, but had to go to bed soon after. I've not seen her since, though I hear her pacing upstairs. Mostly she lies in her bed writing in her notebook. I brought her gifts from the children and letters, but she hasn't read them yet. She does not believe the strange fish on the shore to have been the Essex serpent, but she's had so many strange ideas in her lately, I just squeezed her hand, so hot and so small, and said, of course not, of course not, and let her put a blue ribbon in my hair. It's a cruel disease, but is treating her kindly enough. Now then, Cora, you must allow me the dignity of my years and permit me to give you a dressing down. I've heard it from Charles that you have not yet seen Luke Garrett, that you do not write to either Stella or Will, though you must know she is sick, dying, one rather assumes, though aren't we all in our fashion, and having to do without her children. My dear, I know you grieve. I admit I was never sure what it was that first brought you to Michael, who always frightened me just a bit. Do you mind me saying so? But it was something, and the bond is broken, and you are left untethered. And now it seems you are severing all your ties. Cora, you cannot always keep yourself away from things that hurt you. We all wish that we could, but we cannot. To live at all is to be bruised. I don't know what has come between you and your friends, but I know that none of us was made to be alone. You told me once you forget you are a woman, and I understand it now. You think to be a woman is to be weak. You think ours is a sisterhood of suffering. Perhaps so. But doesn't it take greater strength to walk a mile in pain than 7 miles in none? You are a woman, and must begin to live like one, by which I mean have courage. All love, Catherine. P.S. One odd thing. All that relief, that lightness of heart. The fiddler with a flower in his buttonhole, that marvellous food, but no one took the trouble to climb up Traitor's Oak and take down the horseshoes hanging there. As the sun went down, the wind came up, and there they were, turning and flashing on their bits of string. Don't you think that's strange?
Cora Seaborne, care of the Midland Grand Hotel, London, the 12th of September. My dear Catherine, I took your dressing down on the chin and love you no less than ever. I've displeased everyone, it seems, and am used to it by now. Do you think me self-pitying? Well, I am, though I'd stop if I could find the source of it. Sometimes I think I see what troubles me, but at the last minute look away, it seems so absurd. Who ever heard of a woman brought so low by the loss of a friend? So then, the Essex serpent is found. A month ago, I'd have been utterly furious, but I find myself generally muted these days. I suppose I did think, now and then, that I'd stand on the shore and see the snout of an ichthyosaur poking out of the estuary waters. God knows, I've seen stranger things there. But I can't remember it. It seems absurd, the daydreams of another woman. Last week I took myself off to the Natural History Museum and stood counting the bones of the fossils there, and tried to summon up the wonder it once gave me. And there was nothing. Perhaps you know how cruel I was to Dr. Garrett. Catherine, how could I have known? They don't want me there. I write, and he does not reply. I am not certain that William Ransom wants to see me either. I go blundering about, I break things. I turned out to be no more competent a friend than I have been a wife or mother. Oh, having read just now what I have written, what self-pity! It would do me no good. What would Will say? That we've all fallen short of the glory of God, or something along those lines. At any rate, he never seemed much bothered by the failings of others, since it's all a consequence of the human condition, and only to be expected. Though if that is the case, he ought to bear with my failings rather better than he seems to, or at least keep me informed as to which of my failings has displeased him most. You see how I have become? I was never so girlish, so mournful, even when a girl, even when mourning. I will write to Luke. I will write to Stella. I will go to Oldwinter. I will be good. I promise. Much love, darling Kay. Indeed, you have all of it, since no one else wants it. Cora Seaborne.
Cora Seaborne, care of the Midland Grand Hotel, London, 12th of September. Dear Stella, dear Will, it's usual, I know, to begin with, I hope you are well,
but I know you are not. I was so desperately sorry to hear how ill you have become, and send my love. Did you see Dr. Butler? I'm told he's the best to be had. I am coming back to Essex. Tell me what I can bring. Tell me what you most like to eat. Shall I bring books? There is a man outside the hotel selling peonies. I'll bring as many as I can stuff in a first-class carriage. I hear the Essex serpent was found, and nothing but a great fish after all, and long since dead to boot. Catherine tells me all Old Winter celebrated. How I wish I could have been there and seen it. With love, Cora Seaborn.
Chapter 4.
He's not here, said Stella, closing her blue notebook, tying it with ribbon. He'll be sorry to have missed you. No, don't sit next to me. I don't feel much like coughing, but sometimes it comes when I don't expect it. And what's this? What is this? What have you brought me?
Relief and disappointment weakened Cora at the knee. Concealing it with a smile, she put a parcel in her friend's lap and said, It's only a book I thought you'd like, and some marzipan from Harrod's. We remembered how you like it. Frankie, come and say hello. But Francis was nonplussed and could only stand on the threshold, surveying the room. Never in his years of accumulating treasures had he seen anything like it. He thought himself expert in the collector's art, but knew when he was bested. Stella Ransom lay on a white couch between two open windows hung with blue curtains. She wore a dark blue dressing gown and blue slippers and was decked with turquoise beads. On her hands were gimcrack rings, and on every windowsill blue glass bottles glinted. There were sherry bottles and poison bottles and little flagons for scent. Shards of glass gathered from gutters and opaque nuggets tossed up by the tide. Neatly laid out on tables and chairs were items ordered by depth or pallor of pigment, bottle tops and buttons, silk scraps and folded sheets of paper, feathers and stones, and all of them blue. Awestruck, he knelt a little distance away and said,
I like all your special things. I have special things too.
Stella turned her pansy eyes on him, and without surprise or censure said,
Then we share a habit of finding beauty no one else sees.
She lowered her voice and whispered confidingly,
It is a habit also of the angels, who we sometimes entertain unawares, and lately there's been a lot of them about.
It troubled Cora to see her put her finger to her mouth in a gesture of secrecy, and to see Francis make the gesture in return. The woman had certainly grown stranger in her absence. Was it the disease? Why had Will not written to tell her? Stella then became her old brisk self. She twitched at her dressing gown and said,
Now then, I have lots and lots to ask and tell. How is Dr. Garrett? I couldn't bear it when I was told. I will never forget how he treated me the day I went to hospital. It wasn't the ordinary kindness, you know. He spoke to me as if I were an equal. He wouldn't let them keep it from me. Will he really never operate again? I had been ready to let him do what he wanted with me, but I suppose that's out of the question now.
Cora found that she could not speak of her imp without a pain in her throat, and said carelessly,
Oh, Spencer tells me he's healing well. Can it really be that bad? He didn't lose a finger, and it would take more than a street fight to have him lose his mind. Frankie? No, those aren't yours.
The boy had begun to fetch grey-blue stones from the mantelpiece and to put them on the carpet, and, ignoring his mother, breathed hotly on a flat pebble and polished it on his sleeve.
"Please, let him play. He understands me, I think," said Stella.
And together they watched a moment as he set them out in the pattern of a seven-pointed star, now and then glancing up at Stella in what his mother saw with surprise to be an expression of adoration.
"They took my babies away," said Stella,
drearily, losing for a moment her lightness of heart.
"I remember their faces, of course. I have their photos here. Only I forget how it is to feel their arms around my neck and the weight of them in my lap. It makes me happy to see him there. Let him do what he wants."
Then she leaned against the curved wing of the chair, and Stella saw the high colour on her cheeks burn brighter. When she raised her head again, her hair was dark at the roots with sweat.
"But they're coming back again. Catherine Ambrose is bringing them to me," she said.
She touched the Bible.
"Our Heavenly Father never gives us more than we can bear."
"I dare say," said Cora.
"And they say the Essex serpent is found, and no more than a rotting fish."
Stella leaned forward, secretive, confiding.
"But Cora, do not be deceived. Just last night, a dead dog was cast up at Brightlingsea with its neck broken, and no sign yet of the Banks's girl."
"How gleeful she is," thought Cora. "I believe she is almost willing the serpent back into the black water."
"I hear it whispering in the night," said Stella, "though I never can make out the words."
Cora took her friend's hand. But what, after all, was to be said? Her eyes glittered as if she saw not the hand of judgment, but of redemption. Stella made a few marks in her notebook, then shook her head as if waking from a light sleep, and said,
"Anna, how is Martha?
Cross to find herself back in old winter, I'm sure." She'd not yet lost her habit of gossip, and for a while they ran through all their mutual acquaintances, while Will filled the room with his absence. Francis sat some distance away, observing in his usual fashion. He saw how Stella clutched the notebook, stroking its blue cover, how one moment her attention fixed avidly on what his mother said, then dissipated as she drew dreamy and vague. Sometimes she'd fall to phrases that sat oddly on her tongue.
"The fact is, and I know you agree, that this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality."
Then, immediately after, say briskly,
"Magog doesn't seem at all bothered by Cracknell's death. Her milk's as good as ever."
And all the while, his mother's eyes grew darker, as they did when she was troubled. She patted Stella Ransom's hand and nodded, and never contradicted. She said,
"Tell me again how it is you plait your hair so beautifully. I try, but I can never get it right,"
and poured another cup of tea.
"Come again soon, won't you?"
Stella said when Cora rose to leave.
"How sorry you must be to Miss Will. I will give him all your best. And Master Seaborn," she said, turning to Francis and holding out her hands, "we should be friends, you and me. We understand each other. Come again and bring me your treasures, and we'll compare them, shall we?"
And Francis put his hand in hers and felt how hot it was and how very much smaller than his own. He said,
"I've got 3 jay's feathers and a chrysalis. I'll bring them tomorrow, if you like."
Cora Seaborn, to the Common, Old Winter, 19th of September. Dear Will, I've come back to Essex. The house is cold. I write this sitting so close to the radiator, I have one burning knee and one freezing one. There's a penetrating dampness coming from the walls. It feels personal. Sometimes in the night I think I can smell something like salt and something like fish, only very faintly, coming through the window. And for all they tell me, it was nothing but a poor dead fish overtaken by the tides. It's easy to imagine the Essex serpent still there, watching and waiting, perhaps on the doorstep wanting to be let in. I live in a state of disgrace. Martha is cross with me. When she brings me tea, she slams it down, and I'm invariably splashed. She wants to go back to London, and I can't help thinking she's going away from me somehow. Luke has asked me not to visit, though Spencer has brought him to Colchester for a change of air, and I almost think I could walk there to see him. Spencer writes, but he signs himself Yours Sincerely and doesn't mean a word of it. Catherine Ambrose has taken to giving me a kind of look I can't bear. It's an understanding one, as if she wants me to know that whatever I've done, she'll side with me. Frankly, I'd rather she gave me a slap. Of course, I've always been in disgrace with Frankie, but now more than ever. I believe he has seen something in Stella he was always looking for in me and never found. He respects her. Why wouldn't he? I don't know that I ever met a braver being. And however kindly you write, I often feel I might fall from grace with you. I doubt the wisdom of so much that I have done. Letting Luke loose on Joanna that strange night in June, even having come here at all. Martha says I've been selfish, that I've tried to tether everyone to me and not cared what they might have wanted. I said that this is how we all live, or else we'd only ever be alone, and she slammed the door so hard she broke a square of glass. Only Stella seems not to be angry with me. I spent an afternoon with her. Did she tell you? She kissed my hands. I am afraid for her mind. One moment she sinks into despair, and the next she seems to have already got her foot in the pearly gates. And such a beauty, Will. I never saw anything like it. With her hair fanned out on the pillow and her eyes blazing, I think any painter would run, weeping for their brushes. She does not believe the serpent to have been found. She hears it, she says. It whispers, though she doesn't say what. Tell me how you are. Do you still wake too early and drink coffee in your dressing gown before anyone else wakes? Did you ever finish reading that awful novel about Pompeii? Have you seen a kingfisher yet? Do you ever miss Cracknell and wish you could lean on his gate and watch him skin his moles? Can I see you soon? Yours, Cora. Reverend William Ransom, All Saints Rectory, Old Winter, 20th of September. Dear Cora, Stella told me you'd come. I would have known it anyway. Who else would spend a small fortune on Harrod's sweets? Thank you, by the way. I'm watching her nibble it now, and I'm glad to see her eat something besides teacups of hot Bovril. She's very taken with Frances. She says they're sole companions. Something to do with her new fad for decking the house with odds and ends. I told her I'm writing you a note, and she says, can he come and visit again soon, as she has something to tell him. The doctor says while her coffin's not too bad, she can have visitors for a short while. Did you feel it,
the change in the old winter air. I know you'll have heard how we found that poor dead thing on the shore, and how it woke us all in our beds with its stink. How I wished you'd been there. I remember thinking so at the time. I remember wondering how you could have gone away. That night, it was like May Day and the Harvest Festival come at once. All night they sat out there on the common, singing and dancing with the relief of it. I felt it myself, though I knew there'd be nothing to fear. Poor Evansford looked quite destitute without a day of judgment to look forward to. On Sundays, there are a few more bare pews. Well, I don't grudge anyone a clear conscience. Even so, it's hard not to despair. The house seems quiet as a grave. I've stopped closing my study door since no one ever comes in. The children write nearly every day and are coming next week. When I imagine them running up the garden path, I want to hang a banner up. I want a gun salute. Stella's glad they're coming, but her heart has moved on. Sometimes she tells me she will live, and says it to console me. Then she says, it's eternal life she's looking for, and I think she's run into the graveyard. I love her. We've loved each other so long, I've never been a man and not loved her. I can no more imagine life without her than without my own limbs. Who will I be if she is gone? If she is not looking at me, will I still be here? Will I look in the mirror one morning and find my reflection gone? And how can this be true when news of your coming made me happier than I ever had any right to expect? Every evening, at around 6 p.m, I walk west for a while, away from the marsh and the estuary. Even now, I almost think my nose will never be rid of that awful stench. I find I prefer to turn my back on the water and go into the woods. I'd like to see you. Come out with me. You like a walk, don't you? William Ransom. Chapter 5. She waited on the common in her man's tweed coat, watching all the while for Will. It was too warm an evening for the collar high at the nape of her neck. Autumn was as tentative as summer had been mild. But Cora had lately felt uneasy in herself, and not only when remembering the press of Will's palm on her waist. She wanted to be swathed in heavy clothes, unwomaned by lumpish fabrics and heavy shoes. If Martha had not hidden the scissors, she'd have done away with her hair, and satisfied herself instead with plaiting it severely from her face like a schoolgirl in the morning. It had been so long since she'd seen her friend, she almost wondered if she'd know him. Anxiety at how he might greet her made her mouth run dry. Might he show his sterner side, part chastening, part disappointed? Might he speak warmly, as once he had, or with the diffident manners that chilled her? The wind blew over the black water and brought with it the scent of salt. In the long grass, mushrooms grew and their caps were pearly as oyster shells. When he came, it was silently, as if he'd stolen up like a grinning boy. A light hand touched her arm above the elbow. A voice said, "You needn't have dressed up on my account." The measured cadence and country slowness on the vowels was so familiar and so dear that she could not think why she'd been a little afraid, and spread the skirts of her coat in a curtsy. They surveyed each other a while, unable to keep from smiling. Will had left off his collar, and with the countryman's disdain for the seasons wore no coat. His sleeves were rolled back as if he'd laboured all afternoon, and his shirt was unbuttoned at the throat. His hair had lightened since she'd seen it last, and grown longer. It was almost amber in the evening light. The scar on his cheek,
mimicked the edge of the sheep's hoof, and his eyes seemed smudged, as if he'd rubbed at them while reading an evening paper. "He isn't sleeping," thought Cora with dreadful tenderness. Under his gaze, she knew she'd never looked less handsome. Closeting herself indoors for much of the summer had given her face a greyish pallor, and her neglected hair grew coarsely at the crown. If she consented to look in the mirror, it was to see quite dispassionately the fine lines fanning from the corner of her eyes, the single crease between her brows. All this she felt acutely and with relief. Whatever mistaken moment at midsummer had caused their breach was impossible to countenance now. She was no man's idea of a lover. The thought was so absurd, she laughed with the relief of it. The sound pleased him, because it obliterated the weeks between and put him back in that warm room when first she'd held out her hand. "Come on, Mrs. Seaborn. Let's go," he said. "I feel I've so much to tell you." And far from feeling chastened or suppressed, Cora felt all her recent heaviness of spirit lift. They walked swiftly, matching step for step, leaving behind the village and the briny estuary breeze. They passed All Saints and neither averted their eyes, because it did not occur to them there might be any misdemeanor in taking the evening air. Both had saved such stores of anecdote and complaint, of tall tale and half-formed theory, that fully an hour passed without pause. Each made an inventory of the other, totting up with pleasure the well-remembered gesture or the phrases used too often, the tendency to withhold or exaggerate, the sudden veering off into fresh pastures which the other followed at a run. They delighted in each other then, as they had from the first, without thinking it indecent to smile so much and laugh so readily, while sinking in her blue silk cushions, Stella raised a scrap of cotton to her mouth and withdrew it, flecked with blood, and in Colchester, Luke Garrett felt himself adrift. That each had felt betrayed by the other was not forgiven so much as forgotten. They'd sealed themselves up. They were inviolate.
"And after all that, nothing but a dead fish," said Cora. "So much for the Essex serpent, its wing and beak. Truly, I've never felt more foolish. I took myself off to the reading rooms. I half thought I'd see you there, and did my homework, like any good schoolgirl, and saw the oar fish cast up in Bermuda 30 years ago, and read how they loiter near the surface when they're dying. I must apologize to Mary Anning for disgracing both her sex and her profession."
"But such a fish," said Will, and described for her how the shining skin of its belly had split, and how its contents had writhed on the shingle. When they spoke of Stella, Cora turned her face away. She'd shown Will her tears once before, and had resolved not to do so again.
"She asked to be shown the glass slide in the microscope," said Will, wondering again at his wife's courage. "She looked at what came from her own body, and there was death in it, and she faced it better than I did. I think she'd known for months. She'd seen it all before."
"She's the kind of woman who's misunderstood. They think because she's so pretty and wears her clothes so well and because she gossips and chatters that she's nothing but a ballerina in a jewelry box turning round and round. But I knew from her first letter that she'd a sharpness to her. I don't think she misses anything. Not even now."
"Less now than ever. Though something has changed."
They'd entered the fringes of a wood, The track narrowed, jackdaws convened in the oaks, and brambles tugged at their clothes. Berries had been left to rot on the branch, since all through the months of the trouble no one had felt much like going out alone with their baskets. "Something has changed, and they told me it would, but I never expected this. She had faith, of course, or I couldn't have married her."
"Ah, you are horrified. But how could I ask a woman to spare me every Sunday and half the week between if she didn't serve the same God?"
"Yes, she had a faith, but not like this." It was... He cast about for the right phrase. "It was polite. Do you understand? This, it's different. I find myself embarrassed by it. She sings. I wake in the night, and I hear her singing from along the hall. I think she has the Essex serpent muddled up with Bible stories and doesn't really believe it has gone."
"You sound more of a civil servant than a minister. Don't you think those women who went to the tomb, I forget their names, might have been a little like that, blinded by glory, already half dead, wanting this short time over as soon as possible?"
"No, I'm not mocking you, and God knows I'd never mock her. But if you insist on your faith, you ought at least to concede it's a strange business and very little to do with well-ironed cassocks and the order of service."
She felt her temper rise slightly. She'd forgotten how readily they exasperated each other and considered letting the conversation reach unstable ground, but it was too soon for all that.
"But I do see," she said, growing conciliatory. "Of course I do. Nothing's more troubling than change in those we love. It's a nightmare I have. I've told you about it often, that one day I come home and there's Martha and there's Francis, and they put their hands to their faces and lift them clear away, like masks, and underneath there's loathing."
She shuddered.
"But she's still your Stella, your star of the sea. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds.
What will you do?
What treatment can she have?"
He told her of that anxious afternoon in the hospital with Dr. Butler polite on one side and Luke sardonic on the other. Of how she'd given her own diagnosis and coolly taken in their prescriptions. "Dr. Butler is cautious. He wants to see her again, wants to give her tuberculin, which is the fashion these days. Charles Ambrose says he'll pay, and how can I refuse? I've not been able to afford my pride for a long time."
"And Luke?"
Still she could not quite say the name without a rise of shame that stained her cheek. Will might, with effort, have forgiven the imp, but since his creed made no mention of actually developing affection for those who'd wronged him, he said, "Forgive me, but I'm glad he's prevented from operating. He wanted to collapse her lungs, one at a time, to let the other heal. Don't misunderstand me. I regret very deeply his injury. But really, I cannot think past Stella and her well-being. It's all that matters now." Then he flushed, as if caught out in a lie. "All that matters," he'd said. "And it ought to be. It ought to be."
"What does Stella say?"
Cora was conscious of a sensation very like envy. What must it be to be loved so entirely?
"She tells me Christ is coming to gather up his jewels, and that she's ready," said Will. "I don't believe she much cares one way or the other."
Sometimes she speaks as if this time next year she'll be climbing Traitor's Oak with James, and sometimes I find her lying with her hands crossed over her breast as if she's already in her coffin. And the blue, the incessant blue, she sends me out for violets, and I tell her it's not the same.